The following Dharma talk was given by Jody Hojin Kimmel at the Zen Center of New York City, Fire Lotus Temple. Hojin Sensei is the abbot of the Zen Center and head priest at Zen Mountain Monastery.
Good morning, Brooklyn. This morning I wanted to, first of all, nice to see you on this beautiful wintry day. It was such a nice thing to look out and feel the shift of the snow. Yeah. So I wanted to continue with the stages on the path of enlightenment. We have in the tradition what's called the 10 ox herding pictures. And these are folk images from the 12th century in China. Some come in sets of 10, 12, 6, and they're usually accompanied by a poem and commentaries. And in 1982, we had a Zenga painting master come from Japan. His name was Jikihara Sensei. And he painted all 10 ox herding pictures at the monastery and presented them as a gift. And so upstairs in the Buddha Hall, when we go up afterwards, you'll see all 10 laid out and the poems that go with them. And brush painting is part of my background. I grew up in the arts before I took the Buddhist path, or part of that, and then became a monastic. But it is part of the Zen tradition and has been always used as an expedient means, a skillful means for a teacher to work with a student that sometimes when they couldn't break through and see the ultimate nature of themselves, sometimes the teacher would present a brush image and the student might come to realization from a brush image. Anybody? Anyway. D.T. Suzuki wrote, "The arts of Zen are not intended for utilitarian purposes or for purely aesthetic enjoyment, but are meant to train the mind, indeed, to bring it into contact with ultimate reality." And part of our training, we have art practice or creative expression, which is exactly that, to open up our experience of how we see. And the painters and poets were also the ones who entered the monasteries in the Tang Dynasty with this question of, like, who am I? What is this? What is this self? What is the self and self-expression? We say, I'm trying to express myself. Well, if there isn't one, then what's expressing in self-expression? And we talk about when the self is forgotten, the 10,000 things can come through as the self. So I did the first two stages, and so this is the third stage. And I've been painting them for a number of years, sometimes small, sometimes larger. But I like to keep painting them so I can keep writing the verses and studying them. So usually the ox herder is us, the one who's seeking, the practitioner. That's the ox herder. And that ox herder only appears in the first two images, and then this is the third one, right? And the ox symbolizes our true nature, okay? The experience of being not separate from anything in the universe. Merging. You can think of it as merging with anything we do where the self is forgotten and there's that merging. It's just not two. Thich Nhat Hanh used to call it inner being. So why might these ox herding pictures be helpful to study? I was asking myself, so I can say to you. Well, in a way, the ox mirrors our own spiritual calling and this search that takes place when we're just full of doubt and wonder about what anything is. And we, all the things we've done up to that point in our life where we were told, like, this will bring you happiness, this will bring you happiness. And yeah, to some measure it might, but sometimes it's not. There's still this deep dissatisfactoriness that we feel and that we suffer from. And so I was thinking how we have these anime cartoons and how they can deliver certain human truths that we can hear when it's in a cartoon form. It's so great, right? Like, you know, we're looking at like a toothbrush talking and to a potato, and like they're talking about the human, their situation, and it's like we can hear it somehow. And somehow these ox herding pictures remind me that sometimes we can hear it through an image. We can feel it better. Who knows? But these early pictures, the first two that you'll see, they really show the confusion and the loss and the chasing and the wandering. It's in the weeds. It's like somebody's just standing there and they're like, what's the path? What's the way forward? How do I take a step, that very first one? And I felt reassured looking at them of the difficulties and the doubts that I feel, and that they, sometimes we feel like we're off the path, but those very things that arise are actually the path we start to learn. Those very obscurations that we see and experience and those doubts are the path itself. Nothing has gone wrong. So they kind of are reassuring. Nothing has gone wrong. You can still walk. And we get to see our condition so clearly. They also show that it doesn't end when you look at the end with some dramatic breakthrough. Awakening appears and disappears into ordinariness constantly. It's not an end game. I mean, look at your life. You've had awakenings, right? To different degrees, little by little. And that just goes, Dogen says, endlessly. But we get more confident in a way. And by the way, there's 10, they're not linear. So we might go upstairs and start reading them and go, oh, I'm number 4. Actually, I'm 10. No, I think I'm in the weeds, number 1. So we can come to them at any point in our practice, and we are in each stage all the time. Sometimes we fall into the weeds after practicing a long time. But it's a different kind of weed. It's a different kind of bushwhacking. Because there is a path, and we know it. It shows the ox in these ox herding pictures where the self is befriended. That thoughts, the mind, the self aren't enemies. Though sometimes we do go back to that. And we see that as an enemy. And these ox herding pictures emphasize embodiment. Being in our body, being patient on this path. It's a long path. We need patience, loving kindness, generosity to let our wisdom arise. You know, we're in a culture of getting things instantly. Instantly. I mean, make an order, it's there, like, boop. I had one teacher used to call it McDonald's mentality, that we pull up at a drive-thru and we get our food and we drive off. It's not like that in practice. And ultimately, the pictures undermined their own authority. There's no ox. There's no self. There's no path, no wisdom, no gain. Sound familiar? Heart Sutra. Daido often would say, we should not confuse the map with the terrain. He says, we like to know where we're at, so they're helpful, so we can see, oh, I might kind of be here, but don't confuse the map with the terrain, that it's actually in the sitting, I'm working with the aches and pains and with the body, that the work has to be done. It's not intellectualizing. And the verses that come with it indicate the way to practice. So anyone on this path may be able to locate ourselves without judgment and appreciate the life we have at hand. We had a Japanese visitor come who wanted his son to study at the monastery. And we were speaking in front of the ox herding pictures in the dining hall. And we were admiring them, and we're talking about Jikihara Sensei. And then he goes, my son, he's here. And he points before the first one. And his son is standing right there. Anyway, he didn't come into residency. He said, he's over here. So the first stage, let me just give a review so we can build up to this one, and then I'll share the verse with you. Searching for the ox. So here we are. We start out on a path of practice. This morning, some of you came in for the first time as a practitioner. Whatever moved you, you decided to come to a Zen temple in Brooklyn. Why did you come? Why do we keep returning? Sometimes it's curiosity. Sometimes we know a little bit about the tradition and what Buddha spoke about with suffering, and we are like, I gotta find a path. I gotta find a way. Deep down, perhaps we feel something essential is missing. And we start to look, and, you know, indications, our life feels unsettled, fragmented, a sincere longing for something real and true that we can feel and see and experience for ourselves. So nothing is clear yet. And as soon as we take a step, as soon as you took that step and headed this way, you were on a path. The path opened right in front of you. That's how it happens. The search already began. You may come back here. You may say, thank you very much. It was a nice morning. I will do. And that's good, because it makes another direction. Okay, let me take another direction. We're still walking the path. A path. And then the second stage was we start sitting zazen and we start to see traces of the ox. We start to see a little bit more of the self. We show up again. We've begun some training. When you enter here, you're in training. We have a method, zazen, explanations how to do it. And then we have to put it together in our embodiment, right? You get all these instructions, and there you are. We are putting it together. And I feel like each time we sit down, I sit down, I have to put that together. I never know, after all these years, what a period of zazen will be like. We're changing all the time. And hints of the path start to appear. We start to hear teachings. We start to get moments of clarity. We start to see what we used to do with someone we're not doing now. We're pausing and not reacting, maybe responding a little bit better. We start to get a little bit of, that gives us confidence. And we see practice is worth it. It's worth continuing. I'm gonna just keep going and see what this unfolds, because I have now experiential truth directly. Nobody gave it to me. That's what's so valuable. And in our sitting, we get lost, we go meander, we get found. We get lost, and we get found. And we're beginning to develop what we call jariki. Jariki is ki, is energy. Jariki is the power of concentration. So each time you sit there and you really let go, which means you turn your focus back to your breath or to your count, and you let go, that's building concentration. That's jariki. So that we can put our mind where we want it, when we need to, for as long as we need to. And if you think about our life, there will be situations where this is really going to be what we turn to. We will have that resilience, that strength right there. And you may know that already. Times where you just have to stay and you just have to experience something and you can concentrate. And so in that process of letting go and not running off, we start to get more natural. Natural, I would say. And sometimes we might feel a bit weird. Like who we were is shifting and we don't recognize certain things about ourselves that we're experiencing. It can feel a little unmoored and ungrounded, and we can see how we're always returning to a habit to ground ourselves, even though it's something that we know isn't always helpful. We keep going because it's familiar. So there's a lot of that sort of trusting that it's open, it's opening, right? And we start being able to rest a little bit more, just a little bit more. Still can be pretty consumed with our thoughts. I remember when I first received beginning instruction in college in a small multi-purpose room, and we sat right really close to the wall because a multi-purpose room was so small. I couldn't believe it was multi-purposes. You can barely get in it with a few people. But a monk came from I don't know where and gave us this beginning instruction. I didn't know much about it at that time. This was like 1980s, late 80s. And yeah. And so we did the counting to 10, and you know, very close to the wall. And so I thought, you know, after I finished, I did feel like a bit settled, like more than I had been. And I thought, I'm going to keep doing this in my room. So I set up myself up and I sat still right up against the wall because I didn't know you could move back. I thought that was part of it. I don't know. And I just kept sitting in there. I remember one point realizing that I didn't have to, a thought would arise and that I didn't have to keep thinking it. It was radical. Like I could just see it come up. And I could either like keep going with it, but here was this break that I could do, that I could not suppress it and not keep it going and just let it be and return to this vital life force, this breath that was so vast. I didn't even know where I was breathing from. It was partially my nose, but I felt like every part of me was breathing. It was a weird sensation. And I just kept doing that. And yeah, and later on, when I got to the monastery, I asked this friend of mine, who we went together, who was this monk? What was that about? No recollection whatsoever of ever doing it. And I just was like, did that happen? Like, I kept saying, you don't remember? You took me to this multi-purpose room and this monk came and we counted to 10. Nope. I was like, wow, what was that little black hole somewhere? So then we get to this third stage, seeing the ox, where we actually, maybe for the first time, catch a glimpse of what we're seeing. So here's the poem that goes with it. The preface says, through sound, you gain entry. By sight, face your source. The six senses are non-different. In each daily deed, plainly there, like salt in water or glue in paint, raise your eyebrows. It is nothing other than yourself. The verse. In the trees, nightingales sing and sing again. Sun warms the soft wind. Green willows line the bank. Here is nowhere left for it to hide. Its majestic head and horns no artist could draw. And here's a waka, very short verse. In spring, the sun and the green willow strands see its timeless form. So, in this third stage, we're sitting, we keep coming back, we might start sitting at home, we might start doing half-day sits or intensives, really getting longer periods of zazen where we can really, and something we start to clearly see, maybe just for a moment. Usually it's a very fleeting encounter at this time. Radical, but unmistakable, how it touches the texture of our whole being, enough to confirm that something is larger. We forget the self a bit, just for a bit. The ineffable, we touch the ineffable, the ungraspable. I was thinking of Alan Watts, and he used to say that Zen arts was effing the ineffable. But then some modern people, friends, told me, what are you saying, effing the ineffable? That doesn't sound so good. And I was like, okay. But I understood what he said. We're an expression of what is a mystery that we can't touch, that is ungraspable. And that's something we inexplicably encounter in this moment. There's the six in the preface, the six senses are non-different. The six senses, these are the six roots, our one self, our ourself. Every sense is an entry point to realize our balanced nature in our everyday, ordinary life way. Plainly there, the eye, ear, nose, body, mind, in every act and every activity is the Buddha nature in activity. Harada Roshi has a commentary that I was looking at on these ox herding pictures. And he writes, Buddha nature is the name that is given. But our true nature is not something that is made up or held onto in our heads. It's not just a name. It's alive. It's present. It's real. As Bodhidharma said in his guideline for Zazen, you need to let go of all connections to the external world and let go of all concerns within and not holding on to anything in your head. Sit with your entire body. Eyes seeing, ears hearing, nose smelling the odors, mouth and tongue talking, tasting the salt and the sour, mind awaring. Where is the ox not ever showing its head? Buddha nature is always revealing itself, naked. Nothing hides it. So sometimes at this stage too, people will start working on the koan mu, one of the first koans in the tradition, or what is your original face before your parents were born? And the teacher will say, show me. Don't tell me. Show me. Sometimes people will move to shikantaza, a practice of choiceless awareness, where the concentration and the jiriki is developed and it's strong. So one is not taken by so many appearances. Things can arise and disappear, and we're not taken by it. There's a more dispassion for what's arising in the mind, more rest. It's a glimpse, and we can't force it. So we can't see something, and this is a real sticking point in practice, where we have a experience, and we're going to have a lot of experiences, but you can't recreate it. You can't take it with you. So some people have big openings by naturally or induced by something, and then we want it back. But it's not a thing, and we can't do that, and that kind of takes us away. We can't direct ourselves towards it. We move away from it. So the preface says, through sound she, I'm using my pronoun, through sound she makes an entry and comes to know her source. We don't know exactly what we're seeing, but there's an entry, right? You don't know exactly what you're seeing. Daido Roshi writes, obviously, it's a huge four-legged beast, but that's about it. It could be a moose. It could be a horse. It might not be an ox, but it could be. We have a general sense of what we are looking at, but we cannot swear by it that we really saw it. And this is in working with your teacher. And when I was working with my teacher, this is when I would come in with, like, this is my practice and this is what I'm experiencing. They would share the experience, and that's where the teacher would be able to see how the concentration is developing and what's happening with the student in their practice to help direct them and get them to see that themselves. And usually this breakthrough, of course, comes in these moments when we're absorbed for a few minutes. We might call it samadhi, where we're totally absorbed in the moment. And that's the direct perception of prajna wisdom, a touch of the emptiness of all the conditions, the no-thingness in appearances, that they're not fixed, they're changing. Nothing is solid, right? We really get a glimpse of that. Appearances. The Tibetan yogi, Tilopa, said to his disciple, Naropa, just a little round out here on appearances, and said to think of this, hold this in your heart. The mind is not bound by appearances. The mind is bound by grasping. O Naropa, cut through grasping. That's the thing, right? The mind is not bound by appearances. Means that we're freer than we think. It's the thinking that's holding the cogs, stopping. In Sanskrit, the word for appearances, abhassa, means quite literally what appears. What appears? It's everything, this is from Lama Willa, everything the subjective self experiences, everything that can be seen, heard, smelled, tasted, touched and felt. So it includes everything. Everything out there, the conditions of our life, And it also includes our thoughts, our beliefs, our memories, our intuition, past traumas, habits, emotions. These are appearances. What arises within the mind and heart is appearance. The person who irritates you at work, appearance. That endless train of thought cascading through our mind when we try to meditate, appearances. Our fears, our joys, our hopes, our dreams, appearances. Anything we can have, are, or will experience is appearance. It covers a lot of territory. So when Talopa said that the mind is not bound by appearances, he's saying we're not bound or limited by what happens to us or anyone in our life. We are not bound by it. All the things we blame for our unhappiness are not the root of the problem. The root of unhappiness is grasping as an energy of neediness. It's not like the bad guy. It's just it's understanding what happened. This is how we get into this tangle, this tangling, right? The energy of neediness that reaches into the future for its fulfillment. It's a mindset of insufficiency. We all know this. And we kind of get obsessed with it, this grasping. And then they make a distinction between grasping. Buddha makes a distinction that it's different from attachment. Buddha says, there is an instinctive being within us that responds spontaneously and naturally to its environment. Our practice should not shut down the human. What Talopa meant by grasping is the extra layer of energy that we add on to instinct. Grasping lives in our subtle body. It's that second arrow that we keep grasping, right? The deeper the insight is that these appearances are a kind of visionary experience. The world is coextensive with the person who experiences it. Appearances, as they arise for the one who knows them, are the play of one's own consciousness, the light of one's own awareness. This is the insight that can emerge when we slow down, sit still, and watch. So that's why we sit down and be still, so we can see clearly. So in the trees, nightingales sing and sing again. Sun warms the soft wind, green willows line the bank. So we come to this resting point and we just get a glimpse of what has always been here, what has always been true. We couldn't see because we never got still enough to look, to see. Our mind, to discern. Our mind keeps bouncing around from place to place, analyzing, judging, comparing, systematizing, humming like our Xerox machine. Processing, putting things in our referential files. No focus. But when we get quiet, we can see this insight. This insight comes of the nature of things, of this self. That's what opens up. And then we might grasp again. Keeps coming. It comes throughout. And sometimes some of us have a very strong intellect, so we read about these things. Like people come to me about the three pillars of Zen, where they actually speak about enlightenment experiences. And people are like, how do I get that? Shishin Whip used to say, I want the one on page 63. But what happens is, for those of us that read a lot, that gets verified experientially. But those within us with a strong intellect have to really learn to trust and watch this insidious, let's say, tendency to want to keep intellectualizing. And some of us need to develop the intellect so we can understand what's happening a little bit better. So it's not one's better than the other. So when you have a strong intellect, you begin to learn, when is that like a power tool? Turn it on. Like, let's use that for the good and to really use it. And when can it rest? When is that? We have to develop that more intuitive, instinctual aspect of ourself. So that develops in practice for all of us. So this absolute wisdom has no characteristics, no references, no limits. It's boundless. That's us, this boundless being. And when, as I said, when we become attached or grasping, the mind stops. In the preface, it says, like salt and water or glue and paint. I had to look at that one a little bit longer and research it, because sometimes the phrases come from places. So this one did have a reference, and it said it came from this Heart King inscription by Zenny Daishi. I love these little tidbits, like when you find these little leads, it's like, oh, it's not just, it's there in the poem, but it has this background. And Zenny Daishi writes, salt in running water is not visible to the eye, like the glue that is mixed in paint is not visible to the eye. The eye sees only the colors. In exactly the same way, our Buddha nature has not shape or form, but in our activity, it's present. Here it is, right here, on every seat, present, laughing, crying, getting angry, seeing, hearing. If you take these away, where's the Buddha nature? That's expressing itself. You can't take it away. That's it, being expressed. Raise your eyebrows. It is none other than yourself. So it's not about searching for a world of nothing at all. That will get us nowhere. At least nobody's reported that that was successful or of any use. You can't function in absolute. There's nothing. You'll get hit by a car if you don't know that that's a car and it can run you over. Exactly the same way our Buddha nature has no shape or form. Nor will being attached to everything that we encounter get us anywhere. In the commentary it says, in their every function, it is plainly present, like salt and water or glue and paint. Raise your eyebrows. It is nothing other than yourself. So we dive into that which does zazen, that which works, that which hears, that which sees. Just a glimpse of this ox. We have not really seen the whole thing, not made it our self fully. We don't know this ox completely freely, but it's happening. It's happening. Here's I wanted to share one story from the past, a story from China that illustrates this about Kyogen. You know, may know his koan, Kyogen's man up a tree. Well, he was the disciple of Hakujo and was really like a stellar student, like the best, the creme de la creme. And thousands of monks who were training with his teacher, he was one of the sharpest. And when his teacher Hakujo died, he went to study with a senior brother, Dharma teacher, a disciple of Isan. They had been monks together under the same teacher, so they knew each other very well. And Isan said to Kyogen, "You are an excellent monk, but I do not want to hear your intellectualizations or your explanations." What a good friend. "Before your mother and father were ever born, what was it you knew? Say one word of this. If you cannot tell me, then you should not be here." And Kyogen tried everything he knew, but he was not using his own words. He was using all these quotes because he was really smart. And his brother could sense this. And he said, "Nope. Don't bring me anything that was not your own." So 1 year practice passes, 2 years, 3 years. He's trying to bring something of his own. He sees all these years pass, and still he couldn't see his essence. He had glimpses, but he couldn't see it fully. He was trying. Finally, he went to Isan and he said, "I have nothing more to say." Can you imagine the despair? I've been through that a few times. I've gone into my teacher, "What is it?" "Sorry, I got nothing more to say." "Go back to your seat." Ding, ding, ding. He says, "Won't you please tell me the answer to this?" And the teacher replied, "I can tell you. That would be only my words, not your words. You have to know this from within yourself, not hearing it from somebody else." Kyogen was desperate, being called the best student, and now he was found to have no capability whatsoever. Crushed. Yeah, crushed. Can you imagine the ego withstanding this? Crushed. He decided he would spend the rest of his life cleaning a teacher's grave. I told my teacher this a few weeks ago. "I just want to go up and clean graves in the cemetery." So he found one. It was an ancestor, the sixth ancestor. And he spent 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 more years cleaning this grave. And every single day he cleaned and he did zazen. And his mind was always turning over this question. What was your experience? What was your, show me your original face before your parents were born. What could that be? He gave up on all thinking, all desires, all attachments, and he just cleaned from morning till night. How quiet and clear his mind must have become, and just bringing up that question again and again, living with it, just holding it. And one day, cleaning as usual, gathering up his debris, sweeping and throwing it away out the back gate, his daily ritual. By this day, this time of the day, he grabbed up a bunch of leaves with stones in it, and one of the stones flew out of the dustpan and hit the bamboo, and that sound extended throughout the universe. Just there it was for him, from a sound. He heard this from someone else, and he had this great, deep wonder and astonishment open up inside him. Yeah. The thing he had been working on, this question, opened up for him. He met the ox directly, beyond any idea or dualistic experience. He knew it for himself completely. He didn't need someone else to tell him, yes, you've seen it. A pure experience, hearing sound from a place beyond preconceived notions and ideas and experiences, born fresh from the unborn, a very fresh place. So, we're always so caught up in our past experiences that, or something that's in it filling our mind, that this great wonder, this fresh born amazement doesn't have any space to come through. And that's why we practice doing what you're doing while you're doing it. We sit and we let go of any fixed ideas. So, and when we feel this little opening, this little breakthrough, we practice is aroused. Harada writes, we keep releasing foggy and hazy from the tops of our heads to the bottoms of our feet. Clear, transparent, not too loose, not too tight. Or our zazen is being done without meaning. Let go of all preconceived notions, and with this clarified mind, see the stars, the bright moon, feel the biting cold wind on your skin, feel the bare branches, always returning to see. Be embodied with a fresh, clarified mind. So I'll end with Rinzai's statement on this, which we might be familiar with. He says, in this 5-foot lump of red flesh, there is a true person of no rank who is always coming in and out of the orifices. If you have not seen this true person yet, see it now. Within this physical body that bleeds when it's cut, that true person of no rank encounters the eyes and becomes seeing. It encounters the ears and becomes hearing. Through the hands, it becomes making something. Through the feet, it becomes carrying the body, our body. That true person of no rank, without any smell or shadow of a small self. If you have not realized that true person, that true life energy, do it now. We all have the same exact eyes and ears and nose and body and awareness. If you do not become fixed and hardened on some idea, you will always know this place, which is fresh and new. This mystery is unspeakable. We all know it. And we can open it up. So let this fresh day freshen your mind. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about the Zen Center of New York City's programs, retreats, and residency, or to make a donation, please visit our website, zcnyc.org.